So I'm delighted to be joined by Tony Whitehead, who is the press officer for the RSPB, nonetheless. So if he doesn't know what he's talking about, then what hope is there for the rest of us? Tony, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
And Tony is not just a keen ornithologist, and by keen, just as a marker of that, I think I'm right in saying you've been with the RSPB now for over 31 years. Is that right?
I have, yes. I'm one of those rare people that's only ever worked for one organisation, one company in my life. And for me, that's been the RSPB since leaving university way, way back in the mid-1980s. And I've been very glad to work for the RSPB, obviously because of my love of birds.
Oh, how wonderful. Yes, you are a rare thing indeed. And I should say on top of that, that I know you via a musical friend of mine. And I believe that with her, you've been producing concerts that encourage people to listen differently.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is with the violinist and composer Emma Welton, who's based in Exeter. I'm based on Dartmoor. And we got together about 5 or 6 years ago and to put on a series of concerts we called A Quiet Night In, which was really looking at contemporary composition, but of a very quiet nature, as per the title, that really encouraged listening and a very, very close listening to what it was we were doing, because we were interested in notions of quiet and of silence, but also the effect this would have and the responses from audiences. And we have put on concerts. We probably did, I think we're up to about 13, 14 concerts in the Exeter area and around the southwest now. And we were looking at a wide range of works, particularly interested in the Vondelweiser collective, people like Anton Boyga and Jörg Frey, people like that. We've been putting these things on, we've had good work, and we've had really good reaction to it.
And how brilliant that these concerts are about appreciating things in a new quietness. And that's exactly what we've had almost enforced on us with lockdown. And I suppose it's become a cliche, hasn't it, that lockdown has helped us lock on to birdsong in a new way.
It's been absolutely fascinating, you know, as a listener, because I work for RSPB, but I do a lot of sound recording, also field recording, using my ears all the time. So it's been absolutely fascinating in this period to see the quietening of the environment. And by quietening, what I mean is a lot of the anthropogenic sound, a lot of the sound that's created by us as people, has fallen away. The most remarkable of which is that the skies are now virtually empty, and still are. Previously, if I was doing field recording, even here on Dartmoor, I couldn't go probably half an hour without an aeroplane flying over. And that has not been the case for the last 4 or 5 months. But also car sounds, all these other sounds. I mean, you've had slight increases in sounds like strimmers and people obsessively doing their gardens. But nevertheless, that background sound has fallen away. And I think with that, a lot of people, myself included, have been enjoying hearing what's about. And of course, birdsong, with birds being so part of our lives, that they're literally, they accompany us, they share our daylight hours, people have been just really noticing them.
Absolutely. And as people have heard on my brief dawn chorus walk, Tony does brilliant dawn chorus walks, by the way, you should know this. But on my brief one earlier in this podcast, I was enjoying just the conversations between the birds. Now, you, Tony, as a specialist, both ornithologist and producer of wonderfully attentive concerts, must listen to birdsong in a particular way. How do you listen to the sounds around you?
The first thing of it is I've always had an interest in birds, and it's worthwhile pointing out that if you are into birds, you know, people say it's all, you know, it's about bird watching, and it's not. About 80% of bird watching is actually bird listening, because you just don't see them without listening to them. You don't encounter them without listening to them, because obviously they're quite small and they live in dense environments, so the sounds they make are really important if you're going to encounter more birds. And then what's also interesting related to that is once you start teaching people birdsong, even just the basics, often people are really surprised about how full of birds the world actually is. They've maybe never noticed it before. So, but when I, you know, when I approach it with in terms of listening, the first, for me, the first thing is to try and very, it's almost like what you might call reduced listening. It's just trying to focus on what the quality of those sounds is, because a really important thing with birdsong is it's to identify birds through their songs. It's not about following sequence of notes or patterns. It's much more about timbre. It's much more about getting the quality of the sound. And for that, you do have to do quite a close listening. So I approach it from that point of view of actually trying to focus on the quality of the sound that I'm hearing.
That's fascinating because, again, in my dawn chorus walk, I was struck by how bugling the wrens are and how what a clarion call they have for such a small bird. What's going on there acoustically?
Well, with the wren, I mean, like you say, a tiny little bird, probably weighing, you know, 20, 30 grams, if that. It's a tiny little
really?
Thing. And it's producing this massive sound through the syrinx, this special organ that they have at the junction between the two trachea and the esophagus as it goes up into the throat. It's this and this organ that produces this sound is no bigger than a raindrop. It's tiny. But what they're able to do is to use the air that's going through the syrinx to produce the sound and shape it a little bit, but they're almost using their whole bodies. And if you look at birds like wrens especially, watch them sing and their whole body is quivering, their beak is open, so they're shaping that sound themselves. But beyond that, they're also using the natural environment. They're not singing randomly from places. They are choosing places that have qualities that can help amplify their sounds. So with wrens, they're producing particular places around their territories from which to sing. So it's they're very, very specific, and they have a, you know, a keen sense of hearing themselves to be able to do this.
Do you know, your physical description of the wren, open-throated and almost wobbling with sound, reminded me of a Wagnerian soprano.
It is, so they are literally using their bodies as resonating chambers. I mean, some birds, I mean, away from the group of birds we know as songbirds, some birds such as cranes, for instance, which, as you mentioned, bugling, they're the classic buglers, they have actually the shapes of some of the bones in their necks are designed as resonators. As much as anything else. And so they are literally using their bodies. And what's even more fascinating with that is that birds essentially are dinosaurs. If you go back in time, they're the last surviving dinosaurs of the line of the theropods. If you go back to creatures like even Tyrannosaurus, there are shapes within the bones that themselves might be resonating cavities, which indicates that even dinosaurs might have used their voices to communicate as much as anything else.
Marvellous. Now, on my dawn chorus walk, which was a little ill-fated, I was, I think, erroneously listening out for blackbirds, which happened to be my favourite birds in terms of their bird song. Do you join me on that, Tony? Do you like a blackbird?
My favourite song of all song in the whole world. It has to be Blackbird, yes.
Why is that?
It was one of the earliest birds that I became aware of through its voice. So that's one thing. But also, it's just the rich quality of what the blackbird is doing with its song. It's slightly lower pitched as well. It's sort of coming down more into the human range as well, which I think is interesting. But it's the quality of what it's doing, that lovely mix of melody, and it's doing it's doing pure notes, but it's doing pure notes along with more noises within that, and it's mixing these two things together. And also in terms of where it's singing from, it's the sound of to me the English spring and summer. I mean, it's not exclusively blackbirds are widespread across Europe, but it resonates for me in terms of being this quintessentially English town, city, and village bird.
And yet, I couldn't hear them. In my dawn walk last week. Why was that?
Well, that
is it just me?
Yeah, no. So what's happening at the moment, right at this time of year, we're into July now. The birdsong season is actually relatively short. Blackbirds, for instance, will start singing at the end of January and go through until probably mid to the end of June. From the mid to the end of June, the breeding season has finished and the birds start molting. And as soon as they start molting, changing their feathers over, that's when they stop singing. And then they are quiet, essentially, in terms of blackbirds, through until the following January, with one or two exceptions, but through until the following January and the new breeding season.
So it's not just me. That's it's not good. Just you. Well, let me just go back to the sound of the blackbird, because I think of an alto bebop saxophonist when I listen to blackbirds, the sort of the mellow, rather bronzed middle range sounds, and where you can hear almost notes. And then, as you say, the clicks and the rhythms that go with that just make me think of jazz. Are they improvising?
It's really interesting. Improvising is a very human word. It describes a musical practice that is human. So can you extend it by analogy to birds? And I think you probably can by analogy. You've got to be really careful about not anthropomorphising, not putting what are human characters and human cultural traits onto things that are not human. But by analogy or by metaphor, perhaps you can. And when I think of improvisation personally, I always think of song thrush, and song thrush have a number of perhaps 30 or 40 short little phrases, and they will literally scroll through these as they're going through the songs. There'll be a short phrase, then a gap, and then a different short phrase, and they'll go through them, and then they'll come back to the same phrases that they started off with. But while some of them are very, very similar, there are other ones that they do seem to improvise on, they do seem to riff on, so they slightly change them. And why not? Why wouldn't you do that? You know, is this conscious in terms of how we might think of improvising in us? Who can tell? There's no way we're ever going to tell what's going on inside the bird's mind or what it is to be like a song thrush. But there are elements of that you can compare to improvisation. And the other thing with it is why might a bird be doing that? And one of the explanations is that with complex song, some of the birds might be doing that because it makes them more interesting to either the opposite sex, or more how can I put this, more sort of strong in terms of rival males as well. But the complexity of song coded into that is a signal of fitness for the bird.
Always comes back to Darwin, doesn't it, in a way, in that sense?
Absolutely, it does.
Slightly disappointed. I wanted it to be a bit more poetic than that. But I suppose that's about the listener as well, isn't it? And what we make of it as musicians or as just as lay listeners.
Well, it is. But there's a thing, you know, I always say when I'm doing talks on these things, I want to live in my creative side, I want to live in a world where birds do improvise, where birds are singing for the simple joy of it. And I've had no reason to think that they're not. I have no actual evidence that that's what's doing there. But I would rather live in a world where birds are singing because they're joyful and they're improvising because it feels great. So I'd like to, you know, I'd like to start from that point. But also, when you're considering the science of bird song, that adds other interesting dimensions. And when we look at the amazingly elegant ideas of Darwin and apply it to it, it just adds to it.
I'm glad you're describing Darwinism as elegant. That needs a counterbalance in that way. And talking about sort of the complexity of it, often we focus in, don't we, on just the one species. I was wondering, do birds talk to each other across... is the right word species or subspecies?
To a limited degree. Well, that's interesting. Song to a limited degree, but calls. So within songbirds, this particular group of birds, the passerines, which make up about half the world's species. There's about 4,500 species of songbird. Songbirds, that those songs are actually really meant for others of their same species on the whole, with one or two exceptions on the whole. But birds outside of their songs have all sorts of other vocalizations as well. So they have alarm calls, begging calls in the nest, calls to do with flock and flock stability and making sure that the flock is all together in one. Now, some of those calls, like classically alarm calls, are used by other birds. So if a robin starts alarm calling, other birds are actually pretty tied, tweaked into that, and they will know that there is something wrong in the environment if the robin starts alarm calling. So with calls, yes, those, that's like almost like a universal language. And also not just to birds, other animals are also listening out for those calls because it's useful information. So calls are cross species. Song is probably species specific and just done as to do with the breeding season and to do with both attracting mates and repelling rival males.
And it would seem that when you listen to the symphony of birdsong in the morning, that there is a way in which they're, if not aware of each other, they're at least complementing each other in terms of perhaps not bandwidth so much as the nature and the timbre of the sound, whether it's a rhythmic call. Or, is there something to, that you can comment
there's this idea of a sonic niche, which Bernie Krause came up with a good few years ago now. But Bernie Krause started off life as a musician in the 1960s, but Kate went on to do field recording, got really interested in the natural soundscape, and proposed this idea in terms of what he was doing in terms of tropical areas, that each creature, and that's not just birds, so insects as well, because it's such a dense environment, if they're using their voice, they have to pick their frequency. Otherwise they'll be drowned out by something else. And it seems to stack up, and there is a lot going for us in tropical environments. As you get further north into temperate zones or south, because it's not quite as dense, the theory may not hold together quite as well. But there is something to say that if you're a blackbird and your frequency is, say, 5,000 hertz, and you're a goldcrest at 8,000 hertz, then there's little way you're going to compete in terms of frequency there as well. But there are other explanations for that as well. So we also know in the tropics that a lot of birds will sing in lower frequencies in order to make their voices carry further through very dense, thick-leaved vegetation. So again, they're responding to the environment there. So, but I think Bernie Krause, I like the idea of sonic niche, that each animal has its own literally frequency as a radio station, and they broadcast on that frequency to avoid competition with others.
Sounds very logical. I wonder if we as a human race have our own sonic niches, but that's another question. I want to finish with Mahler's symbolic use of the curlew in the nocturnal movements of his third symphony. So we have this imitation of a glissando, like that, just a sort of a bending upwards on the oboe. I wonder, again, how close that comes to you for the nature and timbre of a curlew call.
It's not bad. I mean, curlew is interesting. Curlew is actually an onomatopoeic name. It comes from the curlew sound. It makes a curlew. So, and you can perhaps pick up at that a little bit of that in what you were saying there. But it does, and there's a mournful quality to the call of the curlew as well. You know, it's often referred to as a bubbling sort of call, and this bubbling call to me is always something to do. I mentioned that moorlands and skylarks, or really curlew is the moorland bird, and that bubbling sound always reminds me of the Pennines, you know, the shadow of which I was brought up. But also estuaries as well, winter estuaries down here where I live in the southwest. That curlew is almost like the keynote sound for these places with its mournful call. But yeah, I think Mahler is doing a pretty good job, and I assume must have heard them as well to do that.
I think so. He's very attached to nature, wasn't he? And that had that symbiotic relationship with his creativity, as did Beethoven, as did many a composer. I can't imagine. It's probably more an exception rather than rule to have a composer that isn't inspired by nature in some way. It's easy to think, Tony, isn't it, that with this apparently plentiful birdsong that we've suddenly become aware of during lockdown, that there is nothing wrong with the situation with our birds at the moment, and they're in plentiful supply. Are we right in thinking that?
Unfortunately not. So you know, the numbers of birds have been falling gradually over the last 40 years for a variety of reasons, in a variety of places, all driven by the way that we are changing our natural environment, and the way we're changing our natural environment is not suiting many members of that of which birds are one. So birds are disappearing. And fascinatingly, a really moving example for me is the curlew itself. You know, here where I live on Dartmoor, a curlew used to be relatively plentiful up there, and currently this year we're down to just two pairs left. So two breeding pairs from when there would have been hundreds up here. And this is the same for curlew right across their range. You know, in places like Ireland, the population has crashed. In the northern moors in England, the population is falling. And this could actually be a bird that, if it carries on this trajectory, will actually become extinct. Now, that's an interesting, I mean, globally extinct, not just extinct within the UK. And what that means is that we will never be able to hear that sound again. And I think that's where you get a real sense of loss, the loss of the ability to see the bird, yes, but it seems to bite more closely when you talk about the loss of the ability to hear the bird, that the only things we will have left are the recordings or the representations in art of a creature that used to exist. We literally lose its voice.
So there you go, listeners. We'll never be able to listen to Mahler's Third Symphony again, quite in the same way, having heard that from Tony. Tony, thank you so much for that depth of insight and just how generous you've been with your time and in explaining so much in so little time. It's been inspirational. And we thank you for your sterling work with the RSPB. Long may it continue.
Thank you very much. It's been great.